Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Expanding Mind here on the Progressive Radio Network, our home for the explorations of the cultures of consciousness. Last night, I saw a terrific DVD. It was part of a book that was just released called Holy Harlots, Femininity, Sexuality, and Black Magic in Brazil, which is already a pretty attractive title. It's by an anthropologist named Kelly Hayes. And I just checked out the book a little bit, I watched, there was an hour-long DVD, and it was about, it was a fascinating piece about particularly one woman, but about a culture of candomblé practitioners in, you know, fairly poor area of Rio de Janeiro. And, you know, candomblé is the sort of African spiritualist-based tradition where possession rituals occur, and there are the kind of gods, so to speak, who are known as the Orisha. But alongside the Orisha, there's also these more tricksterish, if not malevolent, characters called the Exus, and there's a bunch of them. But the main figure is this figure, Exu, who is based on a trickster from West Africa who's known as Exu Elegbara or Legba or Elegua. And something happened interesting, though, in Brazil when, you know, these Orisha, they went into the New World with the slaves where they mixed with peoples from different areas and sometimes Native American stuff, sometimes Catholicism, and it created all these different kinds of similar but also very different forms of African spirituality in the New World. And in Brazil, these trickster figures became associated with the devil more explicitly than they are in most of the rest of the African diaspora. And so what this documentary was about was this one woman in particular whose main spirit that she worked with was one of these devils. But what was interesting about it is that while there was sort of a spooky feeling about her, and she said, like, people didn't treat her very nicely all the time, that she was very devotional about it, and there wasn't anything evil about it whatsoever. And it ended up being very clear how much her working through this figure who was a spirit of a prostitute and who had, you know, lived this crazy life and was sort of coming back to life through her, was a way for this woman to work out all sorts of political, sexual, financial kind of conflicts. And it was a really rich expression of how, let's call them myths, although I think they're more than myths, but how living myths can become places where communities and individuals deal with the real issues of life. And one of the interesting things about it, there were many interesting things about it, was they talked about how little belief really had to do with it, and that everybody who got into the candomblé or anybody who got into working with these issues, they were there for practical reasons. They were sick. They were having money troubles. They needed to go to the lawyer. They were having extramarital problems or whatever, and that it was the experience of encountering these things and having them transform their lives, which clearly they do some of the time, or otherwise the sect would die out because it's a very pragmatic relationship. And that really stayed with me because I think, you know, in the West, among, you know, sort of upper middle class people who are interested in spirituality and mythology, there's often this sort of kind of floaty feeling of this sort of vague quest for meaning. And yet when we really look at a lot of the conditions where these living myths are really alive, and they're really alive in in these traditions with the Orisha. I mean, people get possessed. They talk. You can recognize them. Somebody else is in the house. However you want to account for possession, something really fascinating and rich is going on. But they're also, it's also very, very grounded in real and even banal things. And I think the final thing that kind of intrigued me about it was they were asking, well, it's like this, you basically you're dealing with a devil, and this woman that she incarnated or carried or who rode her head was basically pictured in hell. It was sort of like under Lucifer, and yet the way she talked about it, it was very clear that she was devoted to the good. And at the end, she was saying how she was in the shadows looking for the light, and that was her like kind of mode of spirituality, which is such a powerful image, not just of on a spiritual level, but also in a level of engaging the difficulties of the world, of alienation, of poverty, of conflict, of disease, where we are kind of in the shadows. And yet that looking for the light honors both the shadow side and the light side. So anyway, all of this to say that it was a very appropriate thing to prime my mind for our guest today, Carolyn Casey, who works very much at that overlap of living mythology and political activism, and someone I've been actually wanting to hang out with for quite a long time, so I'm really looking forward to having her on the show or talking to her on the show. But first I want to bring on Maja Daou, the White Witch of L.A. How are you doing, Maja? Are you there? Oh, I don't hear her. Well,
can you hear me?
Oh, now we can.
Oh, that's weird. I don't know what happened. Hi, I'm here.
It's a trickster thing.
It totally is.
So yes. So this is good today because you're an astrologer and Carolyn's an astrologer, so hopefully we can get into a little star magic. I just right off the bat, is there anything kind of special about going on today that I should know about
as an
astro ignoramus?
Eric, it's actually ridiculous because you gave the intro through Santeria and the Orisha, and I have been giving astrology readings at this place called the House of Intuition, and the owners are Santeria. And so, in fact, it's so appropriate that you would talk about that in relation to astrology, because I've literally been doing astrology in a place where the owners practice that religion. So I've been learning a lot about Santeria and kind of Elegba, and in fact, I've been through several of the cleansings that they did there and actually participated in some of the rituals. And so I have been steeped in that as of late, which has been amazing because I didn't really know that much about it. And, you know, Santeria is kind of one of those taboo type religions, like you said, because there is this affiliation with the devil and the tricksters. But really, when you get to know the people that practice it, they do healings, and it's all very healing-centered. And my experience of it is a lot like what you were saying, in that they do try to integrate those things, and the whole basis of it is through exploration of the light. So in doing divination in that kind of environment and doing my astrology readings there have been just crazy synchronicities that have been happening throughout the process that were all totally trickster driven. So I can't think of a more appropriate scenario to talk about today.
Well, wonderful. Well, let's bring on Carolyn, who of course calls herself, as among many things, a compassionate trickster, and who does a sort of teaching mystery school around the figure of the trickster. So, Carolyn, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Yes, that's perfect. And right now, Mercury Elegba is stationing and will go direct on Saturday, Crypt Saturday. And so it's a powerful mythological time. Yeah, Santeria is very dear to my heart. I had an initiation in Cuba. So it is exactly the kind of medicine we want, of syncretism. You know, because as both of you kind of led us into, Santeria is in which the worship of the saints, in which the African divinities, which are really, again, metaphoric garb for intrinsic powers of nature, you know, say, Christianity, sure, you know, there's another sacrificial god, you know, welcome aboard, you know. So this idea of, you know, the gods want to dance with each other in this syncretic form, and we want to offer, you know, other ways of cross-pollinating other than war, you know, what are these collaborations? And as you were doing your intro, I have a fantastic tincture that a wonderful friend of mine brewed Dory Midnight called Witches, Bitches, and Hoes. So I knocked some back immediately. She says it's for healing the holy harlots. And I go, oh, that's perfect. All right, let's heal that thing. And I don't know if you know the movie Dangerous Beauty. It's a wonderful older movie about based on the true journals of Victoria de Franco, who was a courtesan poet in Venice. And she's the only woman we know of in history who was accused of witchcraft by the Inquisition and who beat the rap. And it's really great how she beats the rap. But she says in her soliloquy to the, and defiant soliloquy to the Inquisition, you know, all my life I have fought against the worst fate that can befall a woman, which is of utter inconsequence. And she basically shames all the men that she slept with, everybody, you know, the cardinal and everybody, into stepping forward to back her up, causing the Inquisition to say, the entire city of Venice is cursed and we're packing our bags and leaving. Anyway, so...
Well, that is a stirring tale, very much.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to pick up on one thing you were talking about, of just how you you see these figures as sort of metamorphic metaphors for forces of nature. I mean, because that's something that happens, like, you know, just as somebody who, and I've spent time around voodoo and Santeria and whatever, just because it's in my experience the most striking experience of seeing gods, of seeing people go into states where clearly something else has happened. There's some collective mythological dimension to it, archetypal dimension to it. Even in Burma, I've seen similar kinds of things, even though they come from such a different cultural matrix. And so at the same time, I'm drawn to affirm these experiences, to recognize the power of these god forms and the way in which it's important for many practitioners, not all clearly, but many of them, to really think about them as other beings who they invite into their home and who give them favors, and they give, you know, they slaughter, you know, goats for, or whatever it, or whatever slightly less violent form of feeding that they'll give them. But at the same time, obviously there's something really other than that going on. There's another story behind that story, and so I just love to hear you riff on that.
Yeah, well, let's all co-riff. A pleasure to meet you, Maja. And divination. Yeah, I like to say cooperators are standing by. You know, in our large meta story, you know, if we just sort of weave a little context, and, you know, everybody feel free to and fro. But, you know, so here we are today. It's the anniversary of the ongoing cataclysm in the Gulf, the BP. Tomorrow is, you know, Earth Day and Good Friday together. Well, Earth Day last year was the BP spill. Good Friday is the anniversary of the Exxon Valdez spill and everything difficult that's happened in Alaska. Their 9.5 earthquake was also on Good Friday. So today, you know, tomorrow they are the same. And so it's like, all right, let's, you know, one of the things we say in astrology is create ritual or live melodrama. You know, create theater or live melodrama, the power of ritual to work these forces, you know, so that we don't have to literalize them, you know, including the model of sacrifice. So it's a powerfully resonant time in which I like to think that the gods, the Orishas, the forces of nature are, you know, using every metaphor available to humans, going, wake up, you know, because part of the dynamic of now is that, you know, Pluto, death, rebirth, is squaring Uranus, the trickster. It's an ongoing theme for this year, well into 2016. And it reminds us that in each one of us, you know, deriving from nature, there are some seeds that only come alive after cataclysmic events, you know, a forest fire or a flood, then these seeds bloom. And in the same way in us, you know, after cataclysm, you know, human, individual, or collective, then the rise of the trickster. So I'm pitching this weekend particularly as the resurrection of the trickster redeemer, which is alive in many folk traditions. And we go, yes, that's the part of all of us that we want to encourage. And, you know, as you were mentioning, you know, some of these tricksters are thought of as evil. I view that as sort of late colonialism in a way to once again kind of make inaccessible that which we most need. If we're going to kind of excavate, so Pluto, underworld, I mean, we're stuck with the Greek names and all, but all of the forces that deal with underworld, death, rebirth, kind of alchemy. So a great version of spirited kick-butt women that's very Plutonian is the Wrathful Dakinis. I don't know if you know who they are, Maja. Do you know
Dakini
the Wrathful?
Dakini is my middle name. Seriously. It's no joke, my middle name.
Is Wrathful Dakini?
My middle name is Dakini. My mother lived in Tibet for a while, and she was going to make it my first name, but in fact, it's my middle name.
Right. Okay. So they know about you. So let's invite them. Let's invite them into our cavorting, because the Wrathful Dakinis were, you know, originally they pre-exist Tibetan Buddhism, and they were originally depicted as these wild part animal, part woman beings, like, oh, yeah. And you know, Werner Herzog has a great new film I can't wait to see coming out on the cave paintings of in the south of France from 30,000 years ago, in which, again, fantastic art, and it's all part human, part animal. We are
nothing
without
the... It's opening in LA at the Natural History Museum this Saturday, actually, and he's going to be there.
Oh, it's opening on Crypt Saturday as Mercury the Trickster, presider over the crossroads, is stationing. That's so fantastic.
So good, right?
Yeah. That's wonderful. Well, because the Wrathful Dakinis originally, you know, before Tibetan Buddhism got a hold of them and made them kind of pretty, they weren't pretty. They were beautiful. And they were considered that in nature which metabolizes poison. So the Wrathful Dakinis take the poison of anger and cook it into the tonic of wrath, which is fierce advocacy for all life. And they take, you know, and when we get to the holy harlot realm, they take the poison of seduction and cook it into the tonic of magnetism, bring everything alive. You know, so
it's so interesting, just because I'll just indulge in relating a dream I had, but one of the strongest dreams I've ever had was I was in my mother's house, and on both my hands, two cobras bit at the point between my index finger and thumb, and they were just like hanging there by their teeth, and the venom went in, and I went and saw my mother, and she started freaking out, and she goes, oh my God, we have to go to the hospital, and I literally felt the venom going into my veins, and then I somehow figured out in my brain that it didn't have to be venom, and then I changed it into something else.
Cool.
And then I looked up at her and I said, never mind, we don't have to go to the hospital, it's all good. So I literally actually had a dream of changing poison into a tonic through the cobra venom.
That is, and see, this is a great trick. You know, the trickster part of all of us who can just metabolize the poison. And, you know, part of the what I like to say, well, that's just a great dream. Because the Pythias, the diviners in Delphi, they had to be bitten by a snake in order to participate.
Right.
So it's like, ooh, it's very good, it's very lively. You know, so we love that, again, metabolize the poison. And then, see, what happened was Tibetan Buddhism came along and incorporated the Wrathful Dakinis, but made them kind of, you know, tamer, okay?
Right, they meet the Vajra Yogini, right? The diamond body woman.
Yeah, but they're very pretty, you know. And originally they weren't pretty. They weren't in service to any form of orthodoxy. They were completely free range. And so I like to say that, you know, the divine wants to be liberated from past confines of human imagination, and that's part of the resurrection right now, that, you know, metaphor is incarnational garb whereby power enters the world. You know, and if we think of Pluto, death, rebirth, and the kind of scorpionic realms, and we're going into, you know, Good Friday, and, you know, we'll use all the metaphors. So Pluto associated with sex, death, money, power, all once considered sacred. You know, the backstage, invisible, mysterious realms that all became taboo. You know, and we're all kind of working to change that, right? But part of the dynamic is to take what was sacred, become taboo, restore it back to sacred, you know, the sex, death, money, power. And one of the themes that I work with all the time with self and, you know, astrology clients and world is, you know, better a trickster than a martyr, you know, especially good on Good Friday. And the difference would be there's a part of us, say, born into unconscious family or unconscious culture, who takes on the unconscious material of that family or that culture and then goes, I've taken on the poison of the unconsciousness, and now I feel really horrible. Blah. Okay, that's the martyr model. The trickster model, which is, you know, coming alive in all of us, takes on the unconscious poison, but then has the good sense to invite in that which can transform it, you know, the radical Dakinis, the whatever. And it is this kind of central to our meta story right now, which is, you know, power. And I think Pluto reminds us that we don't source power, we invite it. And that's kind of the essential of an astrology reading or a ritual or, you know, any kind of come on in, you know, and then we direct it like orchestra conductors through the power of blessing. You know, may this go here and may that go there and, you know, may all humans have an increasing experience, empathic experience of the effect of their actions on others. Boom. You know, that in the realm of magic, we're allowed to set anything going of which we would be the happy recipients. That's kind of the criterion. So we go, would we have, be willing to take on an empathic experience of the effect of our actions on others, even every plastic thing we use? And we go, sure, you know, then come on in. You know, so that model and the modern world's confusion and horrific, irreverent pickle that we find ourselves in on Earth Day is that it has mistaken control and dominance for power. And Pluto would say control and dominance are the toxic mimic of power. We want to hand it to the wrathful Dakinis to transform it into, you know, the inviting in of power. In the
That's part of the whole trickster spirit is the sense that I mean, the minute you think that you understand that you've entirely placed something into one category, you're probably wrong, because there's always two things at least going on in anything. So you'd think, control is power, but it's actually no. It's an echo of an idea of power that goes in the wrong direction. And the same thing with anger and wrath. I mean, I think a lot of people get really hung up on this, and frankly a lot of Buddhists as well, because a lot of, you know, sort of straight Buddhists will sort of really deplore anger. It's just like the worst thing impossible. It's like, you know, you talk to Robert Thurman, anger is just completely not part of the ball game. And they're not just saying about the quote-unquote bad anger. There's kind of like a general sense that it's a really, it's too toxic. When, of course, there's this, you know, we could use the word tantric, but I kind of prefer this trickster way that we're talking about, of recognizing that everything is ambivalent. And what I mean by that is everything has this fluctuating potential to go into different directions, and that it's our will and also our dance and also sometimes our submission to what's beyond, you know, our control that allows things to change their value signs. And this was even in the film last night. They talked about the actual figure Eshu, who's the Legba character. And they showed him, and he's this dude with a hat, and he's kind of stumbling around drinking or whatever. And then there was one of the master drummers was saying, the thing about Eshu that people don't understand is that while he's part of this devil realm, is that actually he's completely dependent on what sort of your intention is, that in some ways he's fundamentally amoral rather than immoral. And so that when practitioners are interested in doing things that are positive, positive things happen. And when they're interested in doing things that are negative, well, negative things happen as well. But it's that ambivalence and the way that we're involved in that trickster way. We don't know what it is. We don't even know exactly how it's going to come out. But we have to recognize that the world itself has that ambiguity, which is what the trickster teaches, active ambiguity.
Yes.
Well, I wanted to just add to that, the active ambiguity, because you were talking about it in trickster sense, but that also goes tantric too, Eric, because like a lot of, it's interesting just to bring the Dakinis back into it, because one of their roles in the tantric Buddhism is they are consorts, right? They are these kind of sexual consorts to yogis and enlightened beings, and it's actually through the sex act that the Dakinis confer information to a lot of these, like, I mean, that's what happens with the Kalopa and Naropa and all that kind of stuff. And so the way that they do that is by making that like hermaphroditic kind of alchemical state, right? So they're actually being sexually ambiguous by making them realize that it's like actually a feminine counterpart to themselves. And a lot of the tricksters are also hermaphroditic, so that translates into the tantric material.
Yeah, and then I just want to bring before us one of my favorite things by William Kittredge. He's commenting on a raven rattle, raven, of course, being the kind of trickster bureau chief of the North from the Tsimshian Indians, and he says it's a percussive instrument, except this one is carved into the form of a mythological raven stealing the sun back from captivity, you know, carrying the little red ball of the sun in his mouth, preparing to spit it home. And Kittredge says that's a striking idea, but not half so remarkable as the beings we see riding on the raven, a human figure reclining back in a posture of sexual openness, and a frog crouching over as if preparing to mount, and their tongues, or tongue, red and slender and arcing. It's a single tongue, and a most remarkable thing is it reaches from human to frog and frog to human. It's all the same in this vision, in which we share tongues with the animals in some perfect sexuality while our trickster raven redeploys the sun as in Raven Brought the Light. See, that raven rattle says, this is how we are, inextricably one with everything, however tricked, riding, in fact, on the back of trickiness itself. So I just love that. There's the animal and the thing, and again, the erotic quality of, you know, positive, intimate engagement. And, you know, when we go to the Voodoon realm, you know, again, my favorite trickster redeemers, Haijan the Conqueror lives in the south, and he comes with the enforced diaspora of many different cultures from Africa. And what's crucial about him as the trickster redeemer is he finds a way out of no way, hits a straight lick with a crooked stick, you know, and he liberates everyone, even the tyrant. You know, and when we look, we go, yes, that's so, you know, what a great idea. It's a different model than, you know, so many of our team talk about, you know, we're going to fight for peace and we're going to, I love playing and critiquing and expanding language. And so I also like, you know, Scheherazade as the great storyteller in the Middle East, because what she does through her power and eloquence as a great trick is she liberates all women from the curse, liberates the land, and liberates even the tyrant who has murdered his own heart. So this, if we go back to the south and Haijan's consort, Marie Laveau, an actual, you know, historically true great ancestress figure, the great voodoo queen of New Orleans. And so she, I love what was written about her, which says, Marie Laveau did not create cultural movements, but a woman of her substance understood what was at stake. She saw a role to be played, played it to the hilt, helping to coalesce a scattered and oppressed people into a dynamic culture. It was a moment of cultural ecstasy. Because she worked with everybody. She did the snake dances, Maja, because she could cure yellow fever, her Creole self. She was in good shape with the kind of heretics who were placed quite high up in the cathedral, in the church. And so she was invited into the cathedral in New Orleans to do her snake dances there. We go, yeah, snakes and Christianity, let's mix the whole thing up. That's fantastic. And just to kind of pitch it to all of us, it says we don't have to create cultural movements. This spirit of awakened democracy and kind of the trickster redeemer, you know, is in all of our hearts and blood, you know, and it's global, you know, as we look to Tahrir Square. I mean, everything. So we don't have to create these things, but we do want to offer ourselves to it and to see a role to be played and play it to the hilt, you know, going, all right, we're available, you know, and I think that's part of the Santeria, well, everything realm, to discern the pattern of evolutionary intelligence, the liveliest possibility at any moment, and offer ourselves to that, going, you know, incarnational vessel, you know, come on in. And so the trickster, it's a little different than Buddhism, because one of the great things about the wrathful Dakinis is that they would sit in the back of somebody's lecture and laugh and weep, and the lecturer, important Buddhist teacher or Hindu or whatever, and you go, why are you laughing and weeping? And the wrathful Dakinis would say, we're laughing because what you're saying is groundless nonsense, and we're weeping because people are taking it seriously. And they would say it with such authenticity that the teacher humbug would then fall on his knees and go, you're right, I'm an inauthentic fraud, teach me. You know, so a little bit of that spicy play, you know, the liberating dynamic, and that, you know, even Legba, I view these guys as primarily really positive. I live with an actual coyote dog for, you know, her father was a coyote for 13 years, you know, and I go, a little more compassion would be good, but the trickiness, and I kind of view the negativity as still kind of colonial, post-colonial suppressing or kidnapping of, you know, intrinsically liberating participatory forces. So the Guardian of the Crossroads and, you know, all ritual is literalized metaphor. One of the things that Eshu Legba does, and this weekend is very, very strong, is he pours cool water on the crossroads to cool everyone out. And our word cool, you know, meaning hip, you know, made popular by jazz musicians, is a Yoruba Santeria, you know, or Ifa word, kula kula. And it meant completely responsible. And it also, in Yoruba, it also simultaneously means cool like temperature as it does in English. And so the Yoruba said this powerful technology of language. So what we want to do, like even all of us right now, they said, imagine your head as cool. We're pouring cool waters on our heads and cool waters on the crossroads of our lives and the world. To literally imagine head as cool and all the heat in the head moving to our heart, which is where it belongs, because then as agents of the liberating compassionate trickster, you know, we can then enter hot situations as agents of responsiveness and liberation rather than as, you know, reactive tyranny. So
that's a wonderful, wonderful metaphor. Yeah, I remember first coming across that cool thing when they also talk about it in terms of drummers, where like you'd think, like you hear the most, you know, crazy, ecstatic, wild, you know, counter rhythmic explosion from the master drummer in a West African drum ensemble, and, you know, and it sounds completely, you know, whatever, hot, quote unquote, in terms of being wild or being super energized, super intense. But they'll talk about the necessity for the drummer, for the master drummer, the greatest drummer, to be cool, and that coolness in the midst of heat, of intensity. Well, it's another version of that tantric inversion that we were talking about before in terms of poison or anger into righteous wrath. But we need to take a break here on Expanding Mind. You're listening to Eric Davis with Majadu. We're talking to Carolyn Casey, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
Do you want to listen to your favorite PRN show in your car or when you're out for a jog? You can download any show on the archives at any time. Visit the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com/archives. We can also be found in the iTunes store under Progressive Radio Network. All our archives are free, so go ahead and check them out. Thanks for listening to the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned to stay informed.
The shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
I'm Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
To PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou, here with Eric Davis, and we're talking with Carolyn Casey about tricksters, our favorite. Carolyn, I was wondering if we can talk a little bit about some of those mechanisms of transforming things and how trickster operates. Like, I know a lot of people, especially in America, are a little resistant to trickster energy, and, you know, we're kind of going through a big influx of it, especially this weekend. What would you, like, kind of say is one of your favorite mechanisms to utilize a trickster transformation? Can you kind of pinpoint it to a certain technique for folks that you found in some of your practice, like that would be helpful to people to start, like, keeping in mind when they head into a trickster situation?
Well, I think the model right now with Saturn, god of cool, you know, exalted in Libra, you know, the art of invitation. So it reminds us that we can do nothing by ourselves, we humans. You know, we can't resolve the innumerable irreverent rudeness we've inflicted on the planet by ourselves. It's by ourselves that got us into this pickle. So even in the realm of, you know, making dedications is great. You know, the purpose of vows is to say, oh, spirit of woof that animates the universe, hold me to this. This is the art form of the kind of being I want to be. You know, guide me to this thing. And, you know, in the Sangoma tradition in South Africa that I also love, the word muti means power and medicine, same word, you know, which reminds us that true power is that which heals, and we invite it in, going, come on in, you know, and then distribute it by blessing in our own uniqueness. And So I guess it's so central to my life. I mean, I do trickster trainings for activists to kind of social strategy upgrade, you know, to participate with everything to kind of bring this realm of magic. And Saturn and Libra would remind us that magic simply means a willingness to collaborate with everything, you know. And and also your great name, Maja Dakini Dayu, because there's a wonderful Balinese novel called The Painted Alphabet, in which the dark sorceress is named Datu Dayu, you know.
Oh.
And she's considered she's the small and large things that cause a person to lose faith in life. Not that this is you, but there's a great redemption at the end in which even, you know, the dark sorceress is redeemed as well. You know, everybody's redeemed, you know. But so she's the goddess of stuck drawers that cause people to go, as well as, you know, exploding things, you know, but all those things which cause a person to lose faith in life. When you mentioned, you know, America's wariness about trickster, we go, well, this is interesting, you know, colonized thinking too, because America has a great challenge, a great difficulty distinguishing between the con man and the trickster.
Mm.
And in fact, the trickster liberates us from the con man. You know, when you, Eric, were saying about the drummers, you know, hot but cool, it's very specific in the Yoruba language. They say cool means responsible, again, very Saturn, dedicated. So a cool drummer is dedicated, you know, to bringing the invisible energy into the world stage, and it's just the drummer, the drum, and the divine. No overplaying, no celebrity, no self-importance, just cool, clean. So I think this is, you know, some things are always true, but there are times when they're truer. This time period right now is particularly, cooperators are standing by, you know, awaiting our willingness to cooperate, you know, and you know, to, you know, like Marie Laveau, so that we can see a role to be played and go, that's my role. And that's why I like making the distinction between we want to be unique, kind of Uranus, but not special. Because, see, special is kind of celebrity thing, which makes people passive. Unique, each person who's unique, you know, each one of us and each one of our listeners, then liberates everybody else to cultivate their own uniqueness. So they can look the same, but they're very different, you know. And that's why I like just putting down some criterion, you know, what liberates us and makes us active is tonic, and what makes us passive is toxic. So, you know, it's a great historic moment, you know, friend, ongoing conversations that we're all having, you know, when the culture's in big trouble, it turns to its outsiders at last, you know, and that's where the kind of trickster waits, awaiting our invitation, again, this ingenuity and inventiveness, and against all odds are the odds that trickster likes, and so we go, well, now is kind of perfect. So we're, you know, in inviting in the part of us that likes against all odds, that is intrinsically liberating, you know, and that's why we want to, you know, have our language and our story and our metaphor kind of really fit, you know, again, so many of our team say, you know, we're going to fight global warming, and it's like, no, it's fighting that got us into this hot pickle. You know, how about we want to enlist the ingenuity to collaborate with nature, you know, that, you know, part of the whole dynamic of now is empire, you know, toxic mimic of power, control, and domination, last 2,000 years at least, you know, going, you know, row, you bastards, you know, then it runs on fuel, the fuel from the underworld. You know, I love a friend of mine, Bob Goff, who works with Native Americans and renewable energy. He says when he's talking to evangelicals, because we want to talk to everybody, he says, you don't want the fuel from hell, you know, from the underworld realm of coal and fracking.
That's so funny.
You want the angelic heavenly fuel of wind and sun. And you go, that's very clever. That is just exactly right. You know, speak to everybody in a language they can understand, you know, as we become.
Very good.
Yeah. Yes,
well, I'm curious, what are some of the other, like, you know, kind of concrete tactics or things that or challenges that activists have that you feel can be helped with this sort of mythologic and focus on the trickster energy? Like, they face some real difficulty. People get burned out. They get frustrated. There's the idea of the fighting, us and them. And,
right.
And so what are the kinds of, like, issues that people really come up with who are turning to your work with the trickster?
Well, you know, again, power of metaphor. So one, we probably wouldn't use the word concrete, you know, just for the fun of it. We go, no, living, fluid, you know, pathways, you know. So, you know, that. So I like saying that, you know, we all have qualities like Dorothy's slippers, okay? Things that we've had with us carrying in our magic backpacks for so long that it's now time to kind of open it and pour it forth. So I like saying, you know, each of us has a magic mirror. And we say the secular critic holds up a mirror to society and goes, you know, look, it sucks in detail. Blah, okay. The trickster then, with a wave of the hand, turns the mirror into a window, but look how beautiful it could be. And then with another wave of the hand, turns it into a door. Let's go. So we need all those stages. We need the critique, but I like to say critique without vision is complicitous with dominance. So critique is the first step, going, and then going, but look how beautiful it could be. Here's the unifying vision, goal, story that can unite us all, you know, and then let's go. So this is very useful. You know, I was just reading somebody's, you know, annoying kind of New Age thing, and he was going, you know, let's you know, oh, let's pave the path. You know, he started off, and I'm like, no, not pave the path, you know, for criminy's sake. And then he was saying, you know, we are special. We are the warrior brigade, and, you know, we want to hammer this into your brain, and we're on the front line of the 1st Infantry Division. We are starseed mercenaries. And I go, no. You know, language, metaphor, story team. You know, even I particularly, I've kind of given this up, but I really, you know, want to expand our default setting of language. So many people use the word empower, which for me is kind of like, ugh, because what it really means is power from outside. You know, like Obama used it correctly when he said, we empowered this committee to investigate this or that. You know, but you know, there's so many other words we could use. You know, when people say that's very empowering, okay, how about encouraging, you know, feeds the heart. You know, so, you know, our shape-shifting, you know, to expand our repertoire of language and metaphor so that we become metaphorically agile. And, again, see, the trickster is the spiral. You know, it's the Aikido. It's the art of peace, which is not face off, not be a weenie martyr, but, you know, again, that spiral around, you know, in which we liberate, you know, even the tyrant going, everybody, you know, here's the vision that could unite us all. So again, I'm really dedicated to the actual power of metaphor to invite, you know, woof into world, going, oh, yeah. So yeah, Earth Day and Good Friday, you know, a friend of mine says in some forms of medicine, the killing, the lethal dose and the healing dose are very close together. And so let's think that in the world, you know, let's say this is sufficient, you know, sufficient healing dose, you know, the Fukushima power plants, the, you know, that we want to wheel and deal with the commie going, we are very sorry, and we will force, you know, cut deals. You know, because that's part of Mercury Legba, is you go backstage and you cut deals, you know, in the kind of spiritual marketplace. You go, if, you know, we will give up our dominating technology of nuclear power if you bail us out of this horrific circumstance, you know. Yeah, so pragmatic mysticism is part of this, you know, dynamic. And I think language and metaphor and expanding, because Jornus the Trickster would say to us, we don't really even care, you know, what you guys do. We care that you, the manner in which you do it, that it be from freedom and choice. So you can use any old word you want, but as long as you have 20 to choose from, and you go, and I choose to use the word empower, you know, yeah. Because I have 40 more words I could use, you know, because the unexpected, see, when we use expected language, it actually kind of serves the status quo, and there's already a, you know, a defiant suppression in place. But when we become unexpected, we begin to take the kind of cultural liberating lead. So it's why I like shape-shifting all the words. Like, instead of environmentalist, I like saying sane, reverent people. You know, sane, reverent people had this to say today, and, you know, Republicans came out against sane, reverent people. And, you know, just to play, you know, it's like when people are thinking of divorce, you know, Maja, like when people have Uranus transits to Venus and they go, divorce, I like saying Uranus the Trickster chimes in and says, we are very big gods, you know. We want you to divorce the part of yourself that got you into this pickle, and then whether you stay with this person or leave them is a minor detail.
Right.
You know, so we want you humans to divorce the part of yourself that got you into this horrific exiled relationship.
Well, and that's interesting you pick that word, because the root of divorce actually comes from divide, which is the same root as divination.
Really?
It's a division. Yeah, it's the division is part of, it's like that idea through dividing you get to the whole, like when the zygote goes through its division process, right, to accumulate a bigger picture. So that word divorce specifically is a really good choice to use, but people don't know what it means.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, yes, I'll take your divorce and give you inauguration. Do you know where the word inauguration comes from?
No, what is it?
Oh, it's so fabulous. It comes from the augur, who is the diviner part of all of us, the astrologer. And so the augur, the diviner, would walk out into nature, observe nature's auguries, patterns, flights of birds and all of that, whereby nature would announce who the most responsible human was, and then they would be inaugurated. Isn't that great?
That's good. That's so good.
Let's bring that back.
Well, and the word, the language is really important, because anytime you say a word, it's an invocation, and it's literally a magical process.
Yes.
Like anytime. And spelling, I always remind people that when you spell something, it's a spell.
Yes.
You know, when you spell the letters, you're actually making a magical spell. And trickster and magical properties, pay attention to the words that you use, whether or not you're paying attention. So literally invocation, every word you say.
Exactly. And that's why Elegba represents that part of all of us that resides within and connects us to this external force of, you know, the memosphere and the, you know, and so in astrology, we've got these great English languages, you know, because people are always saying, you don't really believe in that, blah, blah, blah. And you go, well, do you know the word disaster means against the stars, and the same with catastrophe means against the stars, and the antidote.
And desire is de sedere, which is from the stars.
Oh, that's good, too. And the antidote, you know, to a disaster or a catastrophe is to consider, which is with the stars. And so we don't need to know astrology or anything, but when we pause, as we're doing now, to consider, we are lining up, you know, with what wants to happen. And we have a lot of the questions that people ask at Delphi, at the old kind of oracular sources, and where the Pythia was inhaling ethylene, they now know, going, ah. And the questions were not fortune-telling stuff. The questions were mostly, you know, are our plans in accord with the larger divine, with the God? Mm-hmm. And if not, how should we change our plans to come into accord? You know, that's really it. You know, And that's, like, I think, all of us practitioners of the mantic art. Now, there are hoodwinkings, you know, in which anything that makes us passive, you know, why I think we love astrology is that it is this beautiful language of interrelated kinship. And, you know, as you were bringing up, Eric, part of what's great about the Orishas is they are not cozy internal Jungian archetypes, which is another word I'd like to liberate because it's so mechanical in German. But they are actual, like, woo, real forces, like, woo. It's not this cozy thing. It's this wild and unpredictable thing that, you know, there are qualities within us that we think of as planets representing qualities of intelligence residing within each one of us that connect us to that field in the world. Exactly what you're saying, you know, Maja, about, you know, invocation. Language is, you know, magic. That's why, you know, we don't need to be, you know, kind of timid theosophists tiptoeing around going, oh, I said a bad thing. It's the repetitive pattern, you know, that that is the crucial, you know, dynamic and again, our choice. So we are concerned citizens for expanding metaphor and using all of it, going, Christian stuff, fabulous. You know, we'll use that too, you know, especially since the Earth does, you know, the Exxon Valdez spill on Good Friday, you know, friends of mine all coming alive during that time, becoming, you know, ardent activists say, well, the animals died for our sins, you know, on Good Friday, on the Exxon Valdez spill 22 years ago, and ongoing. So we want to make that, we want to honor that sacrifice, to hold up the mirror and go, oh, it's really, really terrible, but here's how we can redeem this, you know, by entering into, you know, collaborative intimacy.
Well, I just love this idea about practical mysticism and language, because, you know, I think a lot of people now, even people who really are, you know, trying to cultivate some kind of, you know, deeper connection through the imagination, through spirituality or whatever, that they just look around the world and it's so, there's so many, you know, quote unquote, real problems, so many actual things that are happening, that it almost seems like what we're trying to be, you know, woken up from is precisely our, you know, addiction to myth. But of course, that too, and the language that comes in, is just, it's another spell. It's another way of organizing reality, except you think you're not doing it. You think you can avoid the mythic animation of language, of spirit, of image, by whatever, using practical words, which will, for, you know, it's just like the issue of, like, you know, some environmentalists who just think that all of the idea of enchanting and reconnecting with nature is actually an obstruction now from
properly managing these declining resources. And you're like, managing these declining resources? You don't think that's a spell?
Right, exactly. You know? And you don't think that serves empire and colonialism?
It's a really strong call to it's a wonderful balance, not just to like enchant with like rich language and turn everything into a sacred poem, but to be conscious and canny and directed in that process is a really good message.
Oh, nice phrasing, conscious and canny. Yes, that's great. Yeah, because you know I have the Visionary Activist show on the Pacifica Network that started 14 years ago, and exactly as you say, at first, people would call up and go, the world is owned by imperialists and capitalists. You know, why do you talk about this spiritual hoo-ha, you know? And I started a section in the show going, what I wish I'd said last week, you know, and I go, that because that is a kind of expression of colonial mind. I go, that is so colonial. Because when you dive into, you know, Hawaiian activists, the whole realm of indigenuity, a great word coined by Curtis Catawba, Native American, indigenuity, you know, South Africa, the civil rights movement here, you know, Hawaii, it's all a call and response between worlds, inviting in the dynamic, you know, power of prayer, and working with, you know, indigenous Hawaiian people. Just one example, you know, was, you know, there was a very bad idea to, do these power plants in the rainforest. And so the Hawaiian people gathered and they invited Pele, okay, underworld volcano goddess, you know, and every time they invited her, the foundation of the power plant would erupt with lava. And the scientists were like, this shouldn't happen, we're going to do it again, you know, and then Pele would erupt again. And they'd go, well, it shouldn't happen, but we're packing our bags and leaving. You know, it's like the Uwa people in Colombia. They were threatened by Standard Oil destroying their lands, and at first they said martyrdom, we're going to kill ourselves, and then they said no, wait, before we do that, we're going to engage in 6 months of ritual, and they did. They did 6 months of ritual in which they invited the oil to hide. Standard Oil came in and did 3 drillings, came up dry, packed, and left.
Wonderful. Those are great, great stories to sort of represent that engaged power of living mythology. But we're going to have to close it up here on Expanding Mind. I want to let listeners know that they can check out more of Carolyn Casey's stuff through the CoyoteNetworkNews.com, which has links to the Visionary Activist Radio Show and our other things. Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, and great to meet you both.
All right. From me and Maja, keep your minds open.